Hello, I'm Jane Crowther and welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film, and a happy new year to you. We're glad to have you on board for 2023. Today I'm joined by contributing editor James Mottram.
Hello, happy new year, Jane.
And this week we are talking music with Mary McCartney, and we're rating her new documentary, If These Walls Could Sing, as well as Sam Mendes' love letter to cinema, Empire of Light, civil rights drama Till, Spanish horror Piggy, and Tom Hanks' heartwarmer A Man Called Otto. But before we get onto those, what have you been watching, James? It's been Christmas. Have you been watching some Christmas telly?
I have been watching some Christmas telly. Actually, it's a show I wanted to watch for years and never got around to it, and it's currently on iPlayer. So if anyone's not seen it and really wants to, definitely give it a chance before they whip it off iPlayer, which was Our Friends in the North, which was the drama from the mid-90s. At the time, you probably wouldn't have realised what an amazing cast it ultimately has, because Daniel Craig is in it before he was, 10 years before he was James Bond, let's say. Mark Strong is in it, Christopher Eccleston, Gina McKee, Malcolm McDowell, incredible cast, sort of sprawling drama that goes from the 60s to the 90s, covering this group of friends who are from Newcastle. So that was one of my treats for the year. I've just started watching The Bear as well on Disney Plus. I don't know if have you seen that yet?
I haven't, but it's on my list.
It seems to have been on the top of a lot of people's 2022, best of TV lists. So I started watching that. White Lotus season 2.
Yes.
That was, everyone's been watching that. So I caught up with a lot of things basically that, haven't quite got around to in 2022, and it was a good chance to do it. What about you?
Been watching award screeners because obviously we have to vote. You and I are in the critics circle. We need to vote for that. I also had to do my first round of voting for BAFTA. So I've just been watching films that I haven't caught at either the festivals or during sort of general workday screenings. Some of them have been super enlightening, and some of them I don't understand why they're even in an awards conversation. But there we are. A couple of those are on this list. So shall we get on to it? Shall we talk about what we can see in cinemas this week? Let's go to the pictures with this one.
Look around you. This whole place is for people who want to escape. People who don't belong anywhere else.
How do you feel?
I do feel a bit numb, I suppose.
The world is changing.
Wow.
You can't reverse it.
Another world.
Happy New Year!
You can't just give up. Don't let them tell you what you can or can't do.
So this is Empire of Light. This is Sam Mendes' love letter to cinema. What's going on in this one, James?
We're set in 1980 in a seaside town, all set around a kind of independent cinema, one of those glorious sort of old-fashioned sort of regal cinemas that you used to get, those kind of beautiful theatres that were clearly built in the 1920s or 30s. And the cinema's run by a man called Donald Ellis, played by Colin Firth, who's a little bit sleazy, we could say.
Yeah.
A little bit sleazy. We'll come to that in a minute. He has a, quite a loyal crew of staff. The deputy manager, Hillary, played by Olivia Colman. There's the projectionist, Norman, played by Toby Jones. And they have a new guy coming to sort of work on the sort of confectionery counter and be an usher, Stephen, played by Michael Ward, who you'll know from Top Boy. So that's kind of the backdrop of the film. Is this sort of cinema? It's a bit dusty. It's a little bit the whole top layer of the cinema is covered in pigeons and things. It's not in the best of shape. But really, it's not about the running of the cinema. It's very much about two characters, Hillary, who is kind of suffering from a mental illness. She's, as you gradually discover, she's clearly been in hospital before. She's suffered from depression. These are bouts that kind of do keep coming back, something she can't really take control of. And then you've got Stephen, who is obviously much younger than her. He's sort of an aspiring academic. He's got ambitions, and he befriends her, and it's largely about their friendship. He also faces a lot of racial prejudice in the town. I mean, this is a lot of the time when the National Front was kicking about. So it's got these various social issues that are running through it, sort of bonded by this friendship between Hillary and Stephen. And it sort of unfolds from there, really.
Did you like it? I mean, this is cinematography by Roger Deakins. It looks gorgeous, doesn't it? I mean, if we're talking about, you know, the love of cinema and the way that light plays, which people do talk about in this film, in ways that real people never speak, it is a lovely sort of thing to look at. But story-wise and actual authenticity-wise, it didn't really feel that for me, did it for you? I mean, you grew up around there. This is probably your cinema life, isn't it?
Not quite. Well, not far. Well, first of all, we should say it was shot in Margate. It's not Margate in the story. It's just a British seaside town. My nearest big town where I did go and see those kind of formative movies was Hastings, so not too far away from Margate, where I can't say I ever went to a cinema as grand as this one. But yeah, it did feel familiar from that point of view. If you're sort of old enough to have sort of come of age, let's say, in the 1980s and seen those kind of movies. I mean, one thing I really did like was sort of sneaking a peek in the background to see all the movie posters that they had on the walls. Yeah. You know, I think one point
19p for a box of Maltesers.
Yeah. The confectionery stand was brilliant. They got all those details spot on. That was probably my problem with the film, is it's not, as I said earlier, it's not really about the running of a cinema. And although you called it a love letter to the cinema, on some level, I didn't really feel like it was that. There's a point, without going into too many sort of spoilers, where a Peter Sellers film is played. And in a way, I felt that film could have been any movie that was chosen. It didn't really strike me as, oh, this is really about these kind of movies that were showing then. It was very much the backdrop to the main story. At one point, they're hosting a sort of local regional premiere of Chariots of Fire. I thought that was quite interesting, and perhaps a bit more could have been made of that. But again, this was all just events that were happening in the cinema. The cinema itself was never under threat or anything like that. It really is just the backdrop to Hillary and Stephen's stories. And in a way, I felt there was just too much crammed in, from her mental health problems to the racism that Stephen faces. For a start, we should say that Mendes, who wrote the script, I think it's his first sort of solo script that he's written. The sort of mental health issues is kind of based on his own experience with his own mother. So there's obviously a lot of heart there as well, and a lot of, you know, genuine sort of authenticity that he's sort of plowing into the story. Yeah, it didn't really quite work for me as a story as a whole. Perhaps if it was fully concentrated on the Olivia Colman character, for example, maybe it would have worked better. But as I say, it felt like there was too much being crammed into it.
Yeah, it felt very much like he'd watched a load of other films like Save Our Cinema and various other things, and had done a pick and mix, essentially, of other films that had celebrated cinema. When I say cinema, I'm not saying, James, like it's about cinema as an art form. I mean that it's very much about celebrating the space that a cinema provides, and that it's a place in the dark where communities come together. It's also, in this case, it's a community come together, which are the team running the cinema, and they're sort of this mismatched family. So in that respect, as you said, I really enjoyed the idea of that cinema, and I definitely had a cinema. The Odeon in Bradford and Unit 4 in Shipley were my little, you know.
Unit 4
in Shipley. Gone now. It's a block of flats. Aww. But it was a little tiny screen room where, you know, I used to go every single week, and, you know, all of that sort of picking your sweeties and your popcorn and going and sitting in the dark, and then, you know, having ushers in sort of the scarlet sort of vests and stuff. All of that. I loved all that, the nostalgia of that. But the story itself seemed very meandering and very button pushing and cynical in a way that I didn't think worked at all. And I didn't believe in the central relationship between the two characters, Hillary and Stephen, who, you know, there is this different generational relationship that happens. I mean, honestly, by the time they were banging in the attic, I just was, what? There's been no chemistry between these two whatsoever. It just felt like it served a purpose. And also the idea of taking a woman of a certain age with mental health issues who needs to take lithium and, you know, has been sectioned before, and using her as a conduit to inspire a young man, which is essentially what this sort of arc is for Stephen, that he needs inspiration and he needs to be spurred on to actually pursue something. And it has to be this broken winged bird, which there's also a very sort of heavy handed thing about pigeons and wings being broken that happens at the beginning. It felt just a bit icky to me. I didn't like it at all. It felt a bit manipulative and using two separate things in a not particularly nice way.
Whereas I quite liked the surrounding characters, particularly Toby Jones as the projectionist. There's a moment where we get to see inside his projection booth and he brings Stephen in and you see all these incredible black and white photos of, you know, some movie stars of the past. And that is a moment that I suppose celebrates cinema on some level. And obviously, this film is arriving in the wake of the, you know, after the pandemic when theatre chains are shutting down and have had so many problems. And that does remind you of the importance of
support your cinema.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that does come across in the film. The Jones character is not given a great deal of screen time, but he's a really important character in that way. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the Colin Firth character, it's at least fun to see Firth playing this quite sleazy character who's married, but we won't go into too many details, but is not particularly faithful, let's say. And that was quite good to see him do something a little bit different. And it reminded me of those, you know, you've seen those sort of characters before. But yeah, I agree with you. The main story was the main problem, unfortunately, with the film. And that's obviously quite a serious problem when you're constructing a film if your main story isn't really working.
Yeah, and, you know, people who love Colin Firth and, you know, his sort of gentlemanly roles might be quite shocked to see him ask someone to suck me off. I mean, it's the second time, actually, we've heard that phrase after, what was that Joe Alwyn film at Cannes?
Oh, Stars at Noon, you mean?
Yes, I believe he said a similar thing. Very jarring coming from Colin Firth's mouth, but entertaining, as you say. Yeah, it made me want to be a projectionist. Maybe you want to go in there and do that, which obviously that no longer exists. That,
you know, if you could get in a time machine and go back to 1980 and then work in a projection booth. Everyone thinks of Cinema Paradiso as the ultimate love letter to cinema, which, you know, very much does feature a projectionist there. And the sort of, you know, you can practically smell the celluloid and touch it and taste it. So not that you'd go around eating celluloid, that'd be weird.
But James, please don't lick celluloid.
Nobody needs that. But you could definitely feel it. And and I think that this film had a little bit of that. There was sort of, you know, again, all the details of the old school cinemas, they got spot on. You could tell that comes from Mendy's memories, I suppose, of visiting movie houses in those days. But yeah, just as I said, just too much packed in, not enough meat on the bones, really.
Well, yes, it is in awards contention. It's a film that's being sort of sent around to people who vote in awards bodies. Any chance?
Well, you mentioned Roger Deakins at the beginning. I mean, practically anything he touches seems to get a nomination. And if anyone can make Margate look beautiful, it's Roger Deakins, and he certainly does. I mean, it looks fantastic. So I would like to see him at least nominated. I don't know whether he'd win against other sort of cinematography contenders, but I wouldn't be surprised to see him in the mix. Other than that, well, Olivia Colman's name always seems to get bandied around. And I thought, you know, what she did well with what she had to do. I don't think it's the strongest performance she's ever given. But again, I wouldn't be surprised if I saw her name mentioned. I thought Michael Ward as well was really good. I think he's a strong character, but I can see you're shaking your head. But that, again, is that because you didn't like the character rather than his performance, if you see what I mean?
I mean, I know, you know, we talk about chemistry reads, people having chemistry reads. There felt like nothing between these two characters at all. He felt completely blank and she felt just this essaying of hysterical. There was no ground between them that I could see why these two people would, you know, connect at all. And so I don't know if that's performance, script, or both, probably both. But I just didn't like his performance at all. And again, maybe, as you say, it's because he didn't have enough to work with. Because he's great. He's great in other things. But this just felt very blank.
I would put this film as an outsider in terms of awards contention, really, you know, with other things that are, you know, in the mix. So I would be surprised if it got any of the major nominations. I mean, I presume you'd say the same.
Yeah, I agree. People Can Make Their Own Mind Up. It's out on Monday the 9th in cinemas. And I suggest you buy a box of Maltesers, because otherwise you'll be fiending for them halfway through the film. Okay, shall we move on then? From one love letter to a building to another, it's this.
When you enter a place with so much history around it...
It's heavy. He's my brother, take one.
It's kind of sacred in a way. People want to come here. They want the sound of Abbey Road.
My name is Mary. Abbey Road Studios has been part of my life for as long as I can remember.
So many massive records were made here. People don't believe that it was just done by accident.
We're trying to get better with things like recording.
So this is If These Walls Could Sing. It's Mary McCartney's documentary about Abbey Road Studios and why it's created so many special recordings, including her father Paul's output with the Beatles. Before we talk about the film, shall we have a listen to what Mary had to say when I sat down with her in Abbey Road Studios to discuss her inspirations and what she learnt about this hallowed space in making the film?
Lady Madonna, lying on the bed, listen to the music playing in your head.
Thank you so much for spending the time to talk to me about this film in Abbey Road, which is just such a sort of iconic and legendary space that everyone has an idea of. So I wondered, when you sort of decided to do a documentary, was it a no-brainer to do this space? Because you've obviously, as you say in the film, you grew up there and obviously you have the connections with your family. Was it just, oh, I want to do that? Or was it something that you had to sort of decide, do I stay away from that for my first film?
My first instinct was to stay away from it. My producers emailed John Batsack, who did Searching for Sugarman and One Day in September. So he's an amazing documentary maker, and Sarah Thompson, his wife, and they approached and said, asked me to do this documentary. And my first instinct was like, maybe not for my first documentary, because maybe I should do something, you know, standing on my own two feet away from it. But then I love documentary, and the ones that are strongest are the places, the ones where people are passionate about their subject. And I had been wanting to do a documentary and move into directing. You know, my background is portrait photography, and I'd done short form directing, but not a feature documentary. So I just thought, what a great team to be invited by, and what a great place. And also, I wanted the challenge. I like a challenge. And to do a documentary about a building seemed sort of like the things that I do classically are quite personal, and they're about people and emotion and about connection. So I was like, well, how do I get that, my style, into a documentary about a building?
The film really does show that the building has a soul. The way people talk about it, they talk about it as a church, as a mother, as all sorts of ways of talking about it. Do you feel that, having spent time in it for this film, do you actually remember when you were little being there?
Well, I do. And I do feel it. I always feel, because I, you know, my mum and dad were recording here when I was little, and we lived around the corner. So we'd come in, and I remember sort of coming into Studio 2 and seeing them and it feeling huge, and just sort of watching them when they were rehearsing or recording. And when you walk into the reception, they had all these, this great gallery of pictures of all the artists and musicians that had been here before. So that was always exciting. But then also there was this picture I remember seeing, and I kind of half remembered. I was like, I remember seeing this picture of my mom leading a pony across a zebra crossing at Abbey Road. So I was like, I really, really want to get that into the documentary. So it kind of went from there, because I had no idea that it was 90 years old. I had no idea of a lot of the actual more factual side of it. So once I was sort of brought on board to direct, it was like, roll your sleeves up, sit down and learn the timeline. So I kind of went from 1931 when Elgar opened it, wrote notes, scribbled things down with my team, my story producer, Billy. And we literally just locked ourselves in a room and pinned it all up on the wall around us. Yeah, it was so much, so much. And then it was like, how do you actually make this into a digestible documentary for an audience that's not going to be a boring history lesson?
And did you find out anything that surprised you about its history?
I mean, everything in it. I didn't really know any of the history. I kind of knew it from wandering in and out. I didn't realize that Elgar opened the studio in 1931. I love Jacqueline Dupré, the cellist, so I was really happy when I found out that she recorded here. And then that tied in beautifully with Sheku, who's a modern cellist now playing. So those full circle moments were really exciting. You know, I wanted to sort of incorporate recording session musicians. So then when I found out that Elton John and Jimmy Page had been here, that was exciting. And then things more like with the Beatles, I didn't realize that the actual sound of Abbey Road, the physical being of Abbey Road, did seep into recording more than I'd realized. Like, they have instruments lying around here, that like Mrs. Mills' piano, who's an artist who recorded here, her piano was the one that was sort of upright piano. They're like, oh, that's the one on Lady Madonna. Or they used to record comedy records here in the, yeah. I didn't realize that. So they have like a library of sound effects that would work their way onto like Dark Side of the Moon. I like those things where it all sort of comes together and the heart of it kind of, you know, the story unfolded and it kind of all made sense, which was good. Because going into it, I wasn't really sure how it was all going to pan out.
And obviously you do get your dad on here. What was that like, having that chat with him? Did you find out things that you hadn't talked to him about before? And do you think that your relationship made him open up a little bit more than he would to another documentary maker making this film?
When it's your family, you kind of don't. I think a lot of kids, they don't pay full attention to what your parents do. And it's sort of like, oh, you know, you don't really sort of learn it like maybe other people that are fans of it would. You don't pay attention in the same way. So it was a really great opportunity to talk to him about things. And I wouldn't know about the recording style or how the Beatles had actually changed the way of recording historically. None of that would have all gone over my head. And that was through our conversations, because I was doing this documentary. It'd be like, I'd go and see him for a weekend. It'd be like, oh, you know, when we went first, he would be like, we'd have to come in through the side entrance, because we were like, the musicians had to come in through the side entrance and the producers came in through the front entrance and the hierarchy. And then you have 3-hour recording sessions. It was like you come in rehearsed, you record for 3 hours, you have a tea break. They had a canteen lady walk in with the tea urn and like a sandwich, and they'd have a cigarette and a cup of tea and then record another song. It was really nice to have the opportunity to talk to him about that, and that was helpful with my research. He also mentioned Sir Joseph Lockwood a couple of times, and he wasn't coming up in my research, and he was sort of head of the MI. And he wasn't in the MI documentary that I'd seen. So that interested me. And I was like, look, we need to find out more about him. So he was quite integral as well to really investing in pop music in the 60s. So he was helpful. And the interview, I think all the interviews, I think, are quite relaxed. I really wanted them to be informal and conversational. And that is why the documentary works for me, is because it's like a conversation and it's quite relaxed for the viewer. I think the viewer is in the room with us.
Yes. Yeah. And there's also, you get, you know, people to play. You're not just sort of having them talk about playing in this room. You're, you know, your dad's having a little tinkle on the piano there. We're getting to hear a beautiful Elgar's symphony happen. Was that sort of goosebumps moment, seeing people actually sort of do that music within that room?
100%. And I kind of asked people, I was like, with Sheku, I was like, would you bring your cello, please? But, you know, he's an amazing artist. And usually to play, you would have time to warm up. And, you know, dad plays a little snippet of Blackbird. It wasn't prearranged. I was like, look, at the end, I was like, look, this guitar's here. If you are in the mood and you don't mind, would you? And Sheku is saying, because, you know, the process is to have much more time to get into playing on camera. But when they did, it was a real goosebumps moment. Sheku, because, you know, he plays so emotionally, and he was in Studio One and at that single cello in the space, and thinking of Jacqueline Dupré and how she influenced him, it worked perfectly. And then dad was in Studio Two, and I have a bit of footage that marries up to it from the time, and just the foot tap on the wooden floor there. It kind of just, from an editing documentary point of view, I was very happy. I think it's a great addition.
And did it really sort of change your perception of music and recording and how it's done, and, you know, understanding things like the bloom of a room, which people talk about, which I'd never sort of considered that rooms sounded different?
Yeah, I'm much more aware. I pay much more attention. And also it was interesting as well, like Giles Martin, because people are like, oh, it does feel magic. Or say, and, you know, I couldn't just have people coming and going, oh, I love Abbey Road. It's amazing. It's sort of like, well, why do you think it's amazing? It's like, not like, oh, it's brilliant. And I loved recording here. So it's sort of like I needed to really coax it out of people. It's like, I couldn't have everyone saying the same thing. So Giles Martin was great because he was really there. You know, he works here so much and he's an amazing producer in his own right. But also he was his dad's ears and he collaborated with him so much. So he's able to really give us insight. And he says in the end, he's sort of like, you know, I kind of think of Abbey Road like a teapot, you know, never meant to wash out a teapot. And that sort of all of the people that are recorded here, the music seeped into the walls. And that's maybe why it's got this real soul to it.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful film. And I also love the fact that, you know, you have this moment where Elton John says he wished he could tell your dad that seeing your dad, you know, play in Abbey Road when he was a session musician was formative to his career. And, you know, whilst I was watching the film, I thought, oh, I'd wonder if that happened. And then you actually did manage to get him to tell that to Paul. That was a lovely moment. Was that lovely for you?
Yeah. Elton John's interview just seems, you know, you can see his enthusiasm. And I think the fact that we recorded him in the studio in Abbey Road, I feel like he wanted to tell that story because it's funny because he was like, oh, well, we were here and then your dad just wandered in and was like, oh, do you want to hear the new song we're working on and played Let It Be? So he was like, that was amazing because he was a, you know, fresh session musician. He was Reginald Dwight. He says, I had no idea I was going to become a performer on stage. I was a session musician and a songwriter. But then also he talks about the smell of fear and this thing of like how you really cut your teeth working at Abbey Road. Because as I was saying, back in the early 60s, you come in, you arrive rehearsed, you work. If you there wasn't like experimenting and spending a day in the studio, you arrive, they put the tape on, you deliver, you're booked, and then you go home. So I love that he's so insightful about the actual process of being a session musician. We managed to get hold of the master recordings, and as he says in it, you know, you can really hear it's him playing. And it was quite late. I'd done the interview, we had the song on the documentary edit, but I hadn't been able to isolate his piano playing. And then when you pull back and you just isolate his piano, you really can hear that it's Elton John playing, and it is pretty phenomenal.
Absolutely. Abbey Road is very sort of mysterious. You're not allowed to take photos in there when you visit. Was it quite tricky to get sort of the bits and pieces you needed for this? Did you have to wheedle your way in?
I don't know if it's so much secretive as it's just not the done thing. Like when you're in a recording studio, and I should have thought of this before I agreed to do it, because they were like, oh, you can have access to the Abbey Road library. And I was like, yay. And thinking there'd be loads of film and footage, but actually, the etiquette is you don't film and take pictures in a recording studio. It's a private space to create music. So maybe that's why they kind of carry it on. They're kind of, that is the etiquette of Abbey Road, is it's a very private, safe, personal space. Like the Fela Kuti section, I really, really wanted to include him because I found out he recorded 3 albums at Abbey Road. But there was no footage. There was nobody around to interview. So it was, those challenges were interesting, but then all the more fulfilling when I actually managed to sort of include it and get enough to sort of make something to have a whole little segment about him.
Yeah, and it feels like a real sort of secret look into a world that people just ordinarily wouldn't see at all. So it totally works on that level. Where does this take you now in terms of documentary filmmaking? Have you got the bug? Do you want to do more of this? Has it put you off? Where does it leave you?
I 100% want to do more of this. I think it felt surprisingly natural for my first time, but I think that's my photography background and also the incredible team in place and the chemistry of working with this team on it, and the challenges have definitely given me the bug. Yeah, watch this space.
So that's Mary talking about, you know, she sort of grew up in the rolling around on the carpets of Abbey Road Studios, and, you know, she's had this chance to take her own relationship with this building and then dig into it and discover, you know, the history of Abbey Road from its very early beginnings with Elgar and his sort of recording of his symphonies there, right the way through to now, and the fact that it's this sought after place that has the perfect bloom, James. It has a bloom in it. You've heard of the bloom in a studio. It's coming to Apple Plus. It's loaded with famous names talking about their experiences, from Elton John to the Gallagher brothers. Found really great archive footage of various artists working in those hallowed walls. Is it something that appeals to you? You're a music fan. Is sort of getting behind the doors of this place something you want to delve into?
Yeah, I definitely would watch it. I mean, I haven't seen it yet, I should say, so I'm very curious to see it. It's such an iconic building. I mean, you, as you said, you went there to interview her. I'm sure you must have got that slight, shiver, let's say, of walking through the doors, because you know how many people have recorded there. You'll see all the, I've been there in the past, and you see, framed photographs everywhere of incredibly famous artists, obviously the Beatles, being among them. It's such a legendary place. And she was right there, I suppose, she's not just a director that's come in, as a director for hire, let's say. She's got an emotional connection to all of this, obviously, because of her father. So, I'd be curious to see, is it all a little bit people waxing lyrical, or are there some interesting stories that it's not just people saying, oh, what an amazing place it is to record?
It's both those things. It is an amazing place to walk through the doors of, as you say. I was lucky enough to go a couple of weeks ago to see the Royal Symphony Orchestra play Bond themes in that studio space and sit in amongst the actual orchestra and listen to that bloom, the famous bloom that they talk about, and also sit in the recording studio and see them sort of temper what they played and how it actually transfers onto a track, and go and sit up in the room that George Martin used to tweak, all of the Beatles output in with the original, recording, the actual tape recording equipment up there. So just in that, it's giddy. And so that's not something a lot of people get to do, because they're very sort of secretive. You're not allowed to take photos in there, etc. So this opportunity is there for everybody to have a look around. And she does take you around all those spaces, so you can really sort of nose about in the space and feel what it's like to sit in there and feel what it's like to go in those rooms. But yeah, in terms of waxing lyrical, of course, people do talk about it in great ways. The Gallagher brothers were huge Beatles fans, so for them, this was, a rite of passage to record there. But also they talk about it just in terms of the way the artists are looked after and given the space, and how everybody that works at Abbey Road has worked there for years. So the man that repairs the microphones has been there for decades. And they give artists the space to really play. And you see that in the sort of recounting of Sergeant Pepper. Paul talks about the fact that they want to a different type of piano sound, and there was this old piano just sat in the background that was Mother So-and-so's from, she was a ragtag artist, and he just started playing Lady Madonna on that one, and that's that noise that works. Or the fact that they were really trying to get the end of a day in the life, and there were all these grand pianos that were just in situ. So you really get the idea that it's this playground, really, for music, that people really experiment. But then the other thing is, of course, that because she's Mary McCartney, she's literally calling up dad's mates and getting them in. So she's got like great people coming in and talking to her in a way that maybe they wouldn't. Ringo's there, obviously old Elton John, but who used to be a session musician at Abbey Road. So from that point of view, it's fascinating if you're at all interested in some of the amazing albums that have been made there.
Mm. Do you actually hear Mary on camera, or do you see her, or does she do voiceover or something?
Yeah, she narrates it, but she also is visible interacting with her dad. And it's kind of lovely that you sort of see that relationship as well between father and daughter. And there's pictures as well of, the time that, Wings used to record there. So both her parents spent a great deal of time there. So it's all that kind of exactly what you think it might be. It actually is that weird magic. And then she also obviously goes into the fact that recording studios, like any industry, has gone through this lull where, people don't necessarily want what it's offering. So they had to diversify and start doing music for films, because that was where there was money, because they were not getting the sessions from musicians anymore. So then it goes into that whole other avenue, which is, you know, the Star Wars theme tunes have all been done here. George Lucas loves it. Spielberg loves it. You know, all of the great directors come here. And all the great film composers want to hear their music recorded within Abbey Road. And so they've really diversified that. So it's about survival as well. And in terms of sort of linking that with Empire of Light, it is about the sort of the use that building is in society. But this is more from a sort of artistic point of view, that, you know, it provided Elgar with a space for his symphonies to reach people. And then it became this playground for people. And then it became this place that music soundtracks are made. And now it's all of those things mixed up together. So it's sort of the space is more than just a building, in the same way that the cinema in Empire of Light is.
Well, yeah, I did not know anything about Elgar at Abbey Road. So that's the, and now I have to watch it just to at least, you know, appreciate the Elgar bit.
Yeah, I mean, Jacqueline Dupree, you know, recorded some of her most amazing tracks there as well, you know, just before she became very ill. So it's just got, it's got this amazing history to it that maybe you know bits and pieces of it, but when it's set out in a 90-minute film, it's actually quite amazing as a space.
Mm. Well, I have to say, I went to school with McCartney's kids in Rye in East
Sussex. Drop, clang.
Name drop. That's the only name drop I can come up with. So I am at least interested to see. Well, I mean, Mary was a few years older than me. He's a few years older than me. So Stella was a year above me. So, yeah, I'll be interested to see. And actually, if you watch Empire of Light, there's even a reference to Paul McCartney living in Rye, which is where I went to school. Although technically it was just down the road in a little village called Peasmarsh where he lives, which is right next to a farm where I used to do a summer job, basically. So we used to see his helicopter taking off in the sky, things like that.
This sounds idyllic, James.
It was, but that was back in the late 80s or something, you know. But yeah, I believe he still lives there. So there you go.
There we go. Those are the links between Empire of Light and If These Walls Could Sing. And there are James's links, personal links as well, just for anyone who might need them. So These Walls Could Sing is out on Apple Plus on Friday. You can see that and maybe be inspired yourself. OK, so from North London and Rye to rural Spain, it's this.
Oink, oink, oink. Eddie, sonríe. ¡Socorro!
¿Y viste algo? ¿Oíste algo raro?
So this is Piggy, Spanish horror film that was, I believe, at Sundance last year. James, what is it about?
So Piggy is about a young teenage girl whose name is Sarah, played by Laura Galán. She's overweight, you might say. Her parents run a butcher's shop, which is not particularly successful. And she sort of is very much isolated from all the other kids at school. There's a group of mean girls that kind of make fun of her quite brutally, actually, and really quite an unpleasant way. Obviously, they're mocking her size and things like that. And there's a sort of incident at a swimming pool where they kind of almost practically try and drown her by sort of, you know, keeping her below water. It's again, quite upsetting sequence early on in the film. As she sort of runs off home, you know, distressed, in tears, she suddenly sees this kind of van and screaming. And a couple of the girls that were sort of tormenting her are basically being pulled inside this van by somebody. And it's clear they're being abducted. And we don't really know what's happening to them after that. And then the police start questioning her. She denies having seen anything. She doesn't really know what to do. But one would presume, you know, subtextually, she's thinking, do I really want to save these girls that have just been, you know, tormenting me? And it kind of unfolds from there. It's an extremely tense piece of work, this kind of balance between her probably needing to do the right thing, but at the same time, do I want to do the right thing for these horrible girls that were so horrible to me and made my life a misery? I won't say too much more about the killer involved, let's say. We'll leave it at that. But, you know, there's going to be more interactions down the line. That's all I'm going to say. It's definitely one that has a lot of tension and will gradually unfold and sort of draw you in, I think.
It sort of reminded me of Call Me By Your Name in the sort of the sense of place that you really can feel this small town, the heat of the summer, the flies buzzing around. There's always like the buzz of a light at night with people sitting out, like just trying to get through the heat. And that stiflingness of that community linked with this girl's stifling sort of home life where she has two parents that treat her very, it's not unkindly always, but not kindly either. Her mother in particular is really quite blunt with her. And then this body shaming that the entire town and her parents, and even her little brother do. It doesn't matter where she goes, people body shame her on social media, in the street, at the pool, through bullying. That seems to be, for me, I mean, you've read it differently, James, that she maybe thought maybe she'd like to see these girls have their comeuppance, but that I felt that she felt she couldn't do anything right because everybody criticized her and everybody linked that to her weight, and that she was stuck in this sort of limbo of not knowing, not having any agency herself because she was denied it by everybody in town and even in her own family, and that this incident awakens something in her. And we see her journey from being passive to being somebody who does have agency and does, you know, take some sort of pride in her appearance and in her being, because it's actually powerful and it's actually strong and it's actually capable. And all of those things are much better than silly things that are being said to her in town. So for me, it was really interesting psychologically, but also, as you say, really tense and creepy and not very nice, and what on earth is going to happen at the end.
No, she does use that phrase at one point of, you know, I never get anything right, I think is the phrase she uses, or something very similar to that. And I think you're right in exactly what you say, that she does go through this journey from, well, to want of a better way of putting it, zero to hero kind of thing. She does have this sort of, she does become more capable. But there was part of me, I don't know, that's how I read it initially, that, you know, these girls are so horrible to her. It's like, well, why should I help you? That's how I suppose I was projecting my own thoughts more than her thoughts. That's probably, maybe that's how I would have reacted if I'd been bullied. It's like, well, why would I help you? She has a lot of opportunities through the film to tell people what she saw on that country lane, which she doesn't really do. I mean, she's being repeatedly interrogated by police. Her mother's there. I mean, her mother is absolutely appalling as a person. The father, I didn't think was too bad, but he almost seems quite browbeaten by the mother. But at one point the mother's kind of saying, right, it's diets for you from now on, it's salad and greens and things like that, and no attempt to sort of educate her about her diet as to why it might be better to have a, you know, more balanced diet or something like that.
She stress eats, and she eats sweets from the shop when she's stressed, when she's unhappy. It's as with any sort of eating disorder, it's not as straightforward as just eating a salad, is it? So I feel like the film really explores that side of it and makes audiences question, what do they really know about people if they are saying or thinking horrible things about them based on their looks?
It's a clever film in terms of, I thought it would work quite well as a horror movie. It's certainly pretty grim in places. There's some grim elements, which we won't sort of spoil, but it worked really well as a teenage, let's call it coming of age story, if you like. You know, what it's like, you know, you don't necessarily have to be overweight to be bullied when you're a teenager. And I think most people will relate in some capacity to having been, I don't know, ostracized by a group of kids at school or something like that. And I think it captures that really, really well. And then to sort of play that out in the middle of this sort of, you know, genre, serial killer, horror movie, whatever you want to call it, was a very clever. I haven't really seen that done before. Nothing that springs to mind anyway, not quite in that way. So I thought that was a clever way of you know, expressing the discomfort of being an adolescent.
Yeah. I mean, and it's also, you know, there is sexuality in this as well, like how you feel about your sexuality and what triggers it, and her trying to explore where her sort of passions might take her, and is it down this avenue? Is it down this avenue? Or no spoilers, but, you know, is this very dark avenue a way that she might find pleasure and get off literally on the thrill of it? That's really interesting. You know, it's another film that periods are introduced to, that's happening as well. And is it a comment on that and hormones? There's all that going on as well. There's so much you could read into this, which is what I really liked about it. I think anyone could watch it and take something very different from it.
And I'd say if you're a kind of person that doesn't like horror films, and I know lots of people that won't watch them because they'll get too scared, I don't think it's one that, well, I say this because I don't really have an issue watching horror movies, but I don't think it's that terrifying that you won't be able to sleep at night or something like that. I think it's grim for sure, but I think it's kind of watchable in that sense. It's not, you know, I'd still say watch it, even if you are a little bit squeamish about horror films. That's what I'd say.
Yes, not too much gore until you get to the end.
Yeah, the end is a little bit gory, but
a little bit gory. Yeah. And you know, it's also got lots of hat tips to Texas Chainsaw Massacre and various other classics. You know, there are certain shots that and certain situations that feel very much sort of like nods to classic horror tropes. So there's that as well. So I think this is a really interesting film, and I personally would prefer to go and see this than Empire of Light.
Yes, it's a very different film to Empire of Light. If you've got money for one cinema trip this week, and those are the two choices you're faced with, I'd probably agree. I'd say give Piggy a go.
Okay, that is in cinemas on Friday, but it's not the only choice you have to make, James. There's also this one. It's time to take a look at history with this.
This was my boy, Emmett Till.
The body of Emmett Lewis Till has been found dead.
Can I at least just fix him up a bit?
No. They have to see it for themselves.
You tell me, Mamie, how is risking your life gonna help them?
Those pictures of your son change people's lives.
I can't look, Mamie. We have to.
The lynching of my son has shown me that what happens to any of us, anywhere in the world, had better be the business of us all.
Okay, so this is Till, true story of Emmett Till, a young man in 1950s America, from Chicago, who traveled to the South to visit relatives, and it did not go well, did it, James?
It really didn't. I mean, this is a very famous story and a very bleak story of this young man, Emmett Till, staying with his relatives. He doesn't really understand, having come from Chicago, just quite what it's like in Mississippi, where his relatives live, in terms of sort of the racial segregation and the horrors that Black people faced on a daily basis there. And at one point early in the film, he's seen chatting to this young white shopkeeper played by Haley Bennett. He's such a sort of genuine, innocent, you could say naive lad. And he sort of says something like, "You look like a movie star." And he means it, you know, completely genuinely. And after that, she clearly informs various other people in her life. And before long, he's literally ripped out of this home where he's staying. And fortunately, I think the director makes a very good decision that we don't see anything of what actually happens to him. But he's ripped away, abducted, beaten and lynched, basically. And what follows is really his mother and his mother's attempt to bring justice to this sort of horrifying crime. We see his body at one point, and that's all you need to see. And even that is absolutely heartbreaking. But there's one point where she brings out a sort of photographer, there's a posse of photographers outside the house, and she brings in a young Black photographer to take a picture of this body, which are sort of images that I suppose became incredibly famous and to some degree galvanized the civil rights movement. I mean, this is really what the film is driving at, is that she was just an ordinary mother living in Chicago. She had no desire to be involved in politics or activism, but of course losing your son in this horrific way forced her to do this, really. And that's ultimately, they're trying to bring justice in an incredibly difficult environment. in a, you know, an environment where whites and blacks are segregated. And yeah, that's really what the story is. It's this sort of document of her travails to try and bring justice to the death of her son.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very famous case. And as you say, it was massively influential in bringing to light to magazine readers who saw this picture. It was published all over the United States to really drive home the fact that it's not theoretical what is happening down in the South, the Jim Crow law. It is real, and people's sons are dying. And I think what's interesting about this film is it could have been about Emmett, and it is obviously about him. He is crucial to this, but it's about a mother's love and what she does with that and how she uses it for positivity, which we've seen with more recent cases as well, with mothers deciding to use that anger, that pain, that frustration to try to ensure that it happens to no one else's son. So from that point of view, it's kind of inspiring as well as incredibly grim. And I really sort of liked the fact that it was focused on the mother, not the actual act, and the idea of something good can come out of something so appalling.
Mm. No, you could so easily have seen another filmmaker have a segment in that film where you see what actually happened to him that night. And even if it had been just 5 minutes long, that would have been 5 minutes too much, basically. And it felt all the more powerful not to show that and to show the aftermath of it. And I think that was one of the really good decisions made in the film. I mean, we should add, playing the mother is Danielle Deadweiler, who's not really an actress I particularly know. She's very up and coming. This has to be the role that propels her, you know, onto the next level. I mean, she's phenomenal in the film, as is, I think, the boy playing Emmett as well, Jalen Hall, who he comes across in this such a sweet, innocent, naive, just such a pleasant boy. You know, and that's exactly what you needed. And he does that so well, this young actor. The few short scenes that he has, he makes you sort of fall in love with him just as a sort of an ordinary, happy-go-lucky kid, basically. To see what happens to him afterwards, it's just even all the more heartbreaking, basically. Yeah, I mean, yeah, two great performances right at the centre of this film.
I mean, we did mention that awards are being talked about for this film, as well as Empire of Light. I do think that she should be on some lists. She's incredible. Her performance is so sort of powerful and tremulous and fearless and everything at the same time, that you absolutely go with her as she goes through this terrible time after her son has died. And yeah, and as you say, the kid, as you know, he's on screen for minutes. It's minutes, but he manages to make such an impression that you miss him immediately that he's gone, and you miss him as an audience member, and you totally relate to his mother's absolute grief at having lost him, because he feels so real and realized and lived in as a character that you just cannot imagine that this could happen to him. And it did.
Her performance as well, I think the word that sort of springs to mind for me is sort of dignified. There's just a certain aspect of that. I mean, as you say, very powerful, tremulous, but there's just the way she approached that character, it's just so dignified, basically. And I really hope she is on some lists. I can't imagine she's not going to be in the conversation. Whether she'll make the cut, I don't know, but it really deserves to. It's a really outstanding performance. We should probably add as well, this is produced, or one of the major producers is Barbara Broccoli, which is obviously, you know, well known for the Bond series. Quite an interesting one for her to be involved with. And I think it's a story that's somehow taken about 18 years to get off the ground. I was reading the other day, it's been almost two decades they've been trying to get this made, and studios weren't interested because obviously it is a difficult, grim story on some level. And, you know, hats off to them for getting it done, getting it over the line, because clearly it has not been easy to get a story like this made. Weirdly, it strangely reminded me of Emancipation, the Will Smith film, in the sense that that is also a film inspired by a photograph of the slave that Will Smith played. And here, of course, again, photography, albeit from a different period in time, plays a very crucial part. But yeah, it's interesting those two films have come around roughly at the same time.
Well, probably bleakly, because some things haven't changed, as we've seen in the news. So yes, if you fancy a little bit of a history lesson, but with a great deal of compassion, Till is in cinemas from Friday. Final film now. Tom Hanks is getting grumpy. It's this.
Hello.
Hello.
What's your name?
Otto.
Otto?
O-T-T-O.
I'm Abby. O-T-T-O.
Got some new neighbors.
Bye.
Nedwid husband.
I brought you some food.
Okay. Bye.
Are you always this unfriendly?
I am not unfriendly.
Okay, you're not. Every word you say is like a warm cuddle.
So this is a man called Otto. James. Who's Otto? What's he up to?
Well, Otto is played by Tom Hanks. He is very grumpy. He lives in a sort of snowy East Coast town in America, and he's a widow, recently widowed. To be blunt, he's suicidal, basically. He's kind of lost his job or been forced out, and he's sort of taken early retirement. But really, I think that's secondary to how he feels about his wife. He's clearly only ever really been in love with one woman. We get quite a few flashbacks to his earlier life when he met his wife, Sonia. And in fact, the young Otto is played by Truman Hanks, Tom's son. And we see how they met. They met on a station platform. It's very cute. She dropped a book and he picked the book up and then runs on the train, even though he hasn't got the right ticket. And that's all quite cute. And he tried to get in the military before, but doesn't really have much of a career going. But, you know, we keep flashing back to these moments, and it gives you an idea that he's not just a grumpy curmudgeon for the sake of it, but clearly he's absolutely heartbroken through the loss of his wife. More than once, he does try and take his own life. At one point, he tries to hang himself, but the rope collapses from the ceiling. He tries to gas himself in his car, in his garage. But at the same time, he has these new neighbors move in next door. So a Mexican family, they're very friendly, but he doesn't really want to be friendly with them. But they kind of ingratiate themselves into his life. We should add my favorite bit of the film. A small cat comes to also sort of pester him for food, as we all know cats love to do. Eventually, he has a few little things to live for, I suppose we could say. He also helps out some people in his community. There's some nasty developers trying to sort of get people out of their houses. So even though he's still missing his wife like crazy, there are a few things to sort of live for through the film. We should add it's also based on A Man Called Ove, which is a Swedish movie. Well, in fact, it was a novel, first of all. It was a sort of big hit, and then turned into a Swedish film, which was actually nominated for a couple of Oscars, including Best Makeup, I think. And yeah, obviously, this is a remake. Not only are the Hanks father and son in it, but Rita Wilson, Tom Hanks's wife, of course, is one of the producers, and I think she sings a song as well, which closes the credits, if I remember rightly. So it's very much a Hanks family production, you could say. Directed by Mark Forster, who, well, we mentioned Bond earlier. He did Quantum of Solace, but lots of other things.
Yeah, don't mention that one.
Don't mention that one. Did Finding Neverland. I think it's the same scriptwriter as Finding Neverland as well, David McGee. So there's some connections there. Forster doesn't do many comedies, and this is sort of a comedy, but it's quite a bleak comedy in some ways. I mean, I didn't find it particularly funny. There are some little moments in it, mainly to do with the cat, but
I mean, it's a very Tom Hanks film, isn't it? It's sort of kind of the opposite to A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood for him. He's the grumpy old man that needs to be warmed up by his neighbors rather than the delightful, optimistic man who's inspiring entire neighborhoods. But it does share that sort of similar thing of making you feel warm and toasty, and making you feel that, you know, humanity isn't a dumpster fire, that maybe there is hope in the world. All the sort of things that you might need on a bleak first week of January when you've gone through Christmas and we're at the beginning of the next year. Do you think it's a heart warmer? I mean, it's a bit cheesy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a bit cheesy. I was sort of moved by it in spite of myself, if that makes any sense. It's like, I know it's not the best film ever made. It is plucking your heartstrings deliberately, like I mentioned a couple of times, with the cat. I mean,
stop mentioning the cat, James. I know you like cats, but
I love the cat, but yeah. But, you know, it just does those deliberate things, doesn't it? Yeah. It plucks those heartstrings deliberately. And there's quite a lot of melodic, soft music playing, quite a few sort of moving songs on the soundtrack. Mark Forster pulls out all the stops, basically, yeah, to sort of make you feel warm and toasty. And actually, like you said, on a winter's day, given the sort of wintry backdrop of the setting, it probably is the perfect time to release the film, I suppose. I think my problem was, and I said this in a review as well, that it feels that the way it treats suicide felt a little bit glib to me. The kind of, you know, these are obviously quite serious issues, and you know, having the rope break, or I mean, the first thing we see him do in the film at all, he's in one of these kind of hardware type stores and he's buying a length of rope, and you have no idea what he's buying the rope for, and he's having an argument with the store owner or the store help about how much he's being charged for the rope because he only wants 5 feet and they only do it by the meter or something.
Yeah,
you have no idea what that rope is for, but of course you find out later on. And yeah, so there's a sort of slightly weird black humor going on in it about the suicide, which didn't really sit particularly easily with me. But by the end, yeah, it does make you feel warm and toasty, even though you kind of know you shouldn't be made to feel warm and toasty by this film.
There's nothing in it that is any surprise. And the neighbour, Mirabelle, who is really walking a very fine tightrope of being really irritating, quirky, is somebody who could really annoy you. She did me. But I saw that the point of her was this nucleus to inspire Otto to think outside of this bleakness that he'd got himself into, this bubble of depression, and that she was designed as a character to puncture that. So she's sort of this, you know, this woman that feeds him nice food, and she's just always interrupting him. She puts her foot in the door to stop him closing the door on her. She's just, ingratiate is a nice way to say, she's just right all up in his grill. So for some folk, that is going to be a very irritating character. But if you want a film that really, you know, there's no curveballs in this, it does exactly what it says on the tin. It's about a man, you know, finding meaning to life, having previously seen none in his existence. And it's done within 90 minutes. That's not going to be a very deep and layered journey, is it?
Do you not think the scene where he's looking after her kids in the hospital for a while, I think she's because she's pregnant, we should add, a clown, a sort of hospital clown that comes and cheers up the kids, comes and does a magic trick for the kids and borrows a coin from him, which turns out to be his sort of lucky coin that his wife had given him years ago, and then the clown doesn't give him back the coin but gives him back another one. He takes a coin from his ear, but it's not the right coin, and he basically gets into a fight with the clown, but we don't actually see the fight, and I really wanted to see Tom Hanks having a fight with a clown. That would have been hilarious, but we don't get it. We just see the aftermath, basically. So I think they missed a trick there, really.
I feel like this says a lot about you psychologically, James.
Yeah, perhaps it does. Yeah.
Perhaps do not
add. Well, some people are scared of clowns. I just want to see clowns beaten up by Tom Hanks. I mean,
also very rubbish clowns. He's quite a rubbish one. But yeah,
he was rubbish.
He does, you know, he hits a clown. He threatens somebody in the street when they're harassing someone learning to drive. He's always shouting at people about their dogs peeing on his walkway. Yeah, he is grumpy. And I quite enjoy seeing Tom Hanks be a bit grumpy. But
he does this. He goes around collecting all the recycling. People who've put the recycling in the wrong
threshold. But doesn't that annoy you?
No, I think that was good. I mean, like, some of his annoyances are actually, I kind of go, yeah, I see where you're coming from. I didn't fight. He's grumpy, but the whole point is, I guess he wasn't that grumpy when he was married and in love with this wonderful woman. I guess life has just disappointed him. He keeps calling people idiots or nitwits. Yes. And I love the word nitwit. That's my favorite word in the film. We should use the word nitwit in 2023 a lot more.
Let's try and get it in your next review.
Okay.
This director is a nitwit. Okay, well, on that note, A Man Called Otto is in cinemas from Friday. It's a warm hug that you totally expect. Right, that's all we have for this week. James, you said if you only got money for one cinema trip, it would be what?
I think, well, as we said it already, but I think Piggy.
Yeah, I agree. I would go for that one. It's more unexpected than any of the rest, although there is some fine work and not so fine work on offer this week. We should say that if you like talking about films, reading about films, being a nerd about films as we are, you can subscribe to this podcast and get it in your inbox all the time, every week when it comes out. Do so because it will make us feel warm, like Otto. Okay, final question then for today before we go. It's time for a listener's question, James. What's the greatest movie scene featuring drawing, painting or sketching?
Well, wow. I wonder, the one I've thought of, I'm just very curious to see if you thought of the same one.
It's the same one as mine. Go.
Titanic! Yeah, but I thought of another one because I'll let you do Titanic. So just because it got re-released recently and it's extremely different from Titanic, Peter Greenaway's The Draftsman's Contract, where they are constantly drawing in that film with their sort of incredibly sort of laser-like precision of this wonderful draftsman who's doing all these elaborate sketches. So I'm going to go for that one, basically. Tell me about Titanic.
You can't think about drawing or sketching without thinking of Paint Me Like One of Your French Girls, Jack, with the heart of the ocean lying between beautiful breasts as Kate Winslet lies on a chaise longue, and young Jack, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, sketches her, and love is formed over the top of the sketchbook. And I think it's James Cameron actually doing the sketching. I think those are his hands.
That is good Cameron knowledge. I did not know that.
I think it is, because I think he's quite a good drawer, as you would be if you've envisaged Pandora.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, the last time he wasn't in Pandora was Titanic.
Let us know if you have other drawing, painting, sketching moments in film that you think we should have talked about. We're on Twitter. But until next week, it's time to say goodbye. So say goodbye, James.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. Join us next week.